sign and then to be in Carolina in the morning.
In Carolina.
No one could be sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson with the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading excerpts from What the University of North Carolina Meant to Me by Albert Coates, Professor Emeritus at the Law School at UNC Chapel Hill. The Public School. If my family and kinfolk, my schoolmates, teachers, neighbors, and friends in Smithfield and in Pleasant Grove Township are what Smithfield and Johnston County meant to me, the public school was the heart and center of that meaning. That public school found its underpinning in the resolve of mothers and fathers in Smithfield and Johnston County to give their children a better schooling than they had had. They had thrilled to the words of Governor Charles B. Aycock around the turn of the century. They heard him say to the people of North Carolina in his political campaign for the governorship in 1900, "If you vote for me, I want you to do so with the distinct understanding that I shall devote the 4 years of my official term to the upbuilding of the public schools of North Carolina." And later they heard him say, "The question now confronting North Carolina is the education of her children, and this can only be accomplished by the creation of a public opinion so potent that no man will dare to leave his child out of the schools. I want to create a sentiment in North Carolina that will keep any little boy or girl from having to make a support for his father who is sitting on the corner whittling a piece of white pine." I was 4 years old, living on a farm in Pleasant Grove Township in Johnston County, when Aycock made those statements. They heard him say, "We have in the South today our Hills, our Lamars, our Becks, our Vests, our Vances, and our Hamptons. But no man can go through the country and lay his hand on the head of any single child and say that here is a Lamar, here is a Vance, or a Vest, or a Hill, or a Hampton, or a Beck. It is the business of the schools to find for us these splendid children and develop them into these great leaders. If I believed in universal education for no other reason, this would be to me a sufficient one." I was 7 years old, living on a farm near Smithfield, and in the third grade in school when Aycock made that statement. They heard him say, in the opening statement of his campaign for the United States Senate in 1912, "Equal, that is the word. On that word I plant myself and my party, the equal right of every child born on earth to have the opportunity to burgeon out all there is within him." I was 16 years old, and in the 10th grade in school when Aycock made that statement. I've not forgotten that the Smithfield Public Schools that started me on the road to education did not start full-grown in the early 1900s. They rested on the efforts of generations that had gone before. They rested on the report of Archibald D. Murphy to the General Assembly of 1817, recommending that two or more primary schools be established in each county, with 10 or more regional academies. They rested on the action of the General Assembly of 1825, creating the Literary Board and Fund for the Establishment of Common Schools. They rested on the Public School Law of 1839, authorizing the establishment of school districts in each county, quote, "containing not more than 6 square miles, but having regard to the number of white children in each," giving the county court in each county the authority to, quote, "levy a tax to the amount of $20 for each district, with the state giving $40 to each district where the vote was in favor of schools and where a schoolhouse was erected, quote, of sufficient size to accommodate at least 50 scholars. I have not forgotten that it was the private schools scattered here and there throughout the state that prepared the ground and planted the seeds of education in North Carolina, and that these private schools, for a few people, became demonstration centers that blazed the trail leading to common schools for all the people. It is written in the Harvest edition of the Smithfield Herald of August 1961 that the minutes of the county court in 1804 record a petition by inhabitants of the county, quote, praying the court to give them the use of the upper part of the courthouse in the recess of the courts for the purpose of establishing a seminary of learning therein, that the prayer of the same is accordingly granted, and that the need for a more convenient place for a school led to the building of the Smithfield Academy in 1815, situated in what is now Riverside Cemetery. It is written in the Harvest edition of the Smithfield Herald of August 1964 that Dr. William N. White was in charge of the Smithfield Academy in 1813, Robert Brevard Poor in 1820, Reverend A. W. Guy in 1827, Reverend J. Warnock in 1828, William Broom in 1835. It's also recorded that Ira Turlington came out of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill in the 1880s, that in the latter 1880s, the 1890s, and early 1900s, he taught in private schools, and that he founded Turlington Institute as his own private enterprise. I have not forgotten that all of these movements, stirring among the people of the state throughout its history, were brought home to me in the public schools of Smithfield and Johnston County in the years from 1896 to 1914. I am a child of the public schools. I went to the public schools in Smithfield for 11 of the 18 years from 1896, when I was born, to 1914, when I went to the university. And I was the beneficiary of all the aspirations, efforts, and achievements of the people of Smithfield and Johnston County, quickened by the inspiring leadership of Charles B. Aycock. Chapter 2, First Impressions. I began my freshman year at the University of North Carolina in September 1914. A few scattered impressions remembered from my first days in Chapel Hill will give some idea of the difference it made in my life from the start. There was University Station, 15 miles or more from Chapel Hill, and connected with it by a spur track, which did rush business with the coming and going of students in September and June, and in the Christmas holidays. There was a two-hour wait at the station between the arrivals of the eastbound and westbound trains, and this interval was the beginning of college life. Freshmen would meet freshmen. Old students would renew former associations. A post office, a country store, railroad tracks, and a crossroads were the only things in sight. There was nothing to do but get acquainted, and this process continued on the slow creaking ride to Carborough, which was a mile from Chapel Hill. There were rock walls in Chapel Hill, miles of them, along the edge of the university campus and the front yards of professors. I had just come from clearing new ground on our farm, toting rocks out of the field and piling them in a gully. It was hard, backbreaking work in the August sun. I could not see the beauty of the old, gray, weathered rock walls in Chapel Hill, for thinking of the hard, tiring labor of the men who put them there. There were the grass lawns. I had been brought up to be an enemy of grass, to kill it as I would a snake, to cut it out by the roots. A whipping had been in order when I snagged it and left the roots to sprout again. But here in Chapel Hill, I saw people planting grass, using lawnmowers to clip it, leaving the roots to grow again, and in dry weather, sprinkling the grass. There were houses on Franklin Street, set back from the street and protected by ancient trees. There was the campus with its magnificent oaks and poplars, and the great expanse of green lawn reaching from South Building to Franklin Street, and from the other side of South Building to the Raleigh-Pittsboro Road. There was the quadrangle, Old East, Old West, and South, flanked by New East and New West, the center of the campus. And there were dormitories, classrooms, laboratories, and an administration building in the offing. Robert House has described the informal singing sprees on the campus any time, but usually after supper when the weather was good. We sang anything we knew by heart, from Sweet Adeline to The Soldier's Chorus from Faust. Our musical library for further adventures was a collection of paperbacks issued free of charge by the makers of Wine of Cardooey. The Old Well and the surrounding space in front of South Building and between Old East and Old West was the usual center of this musical activity. A student writing in the University Magazine in the 1850s attributed the popularity of the Old Well in those days to a fleeing bootlegger who, officers in hot pursuit, dropped a barrel of rum into it, causing a majority of students to sign up for the Temperance Society. There were the opening ceremonies on college night, when all of the new students, and many of the old, gathered in Girard Hall to hear senior students explain college life and its activities, not including studies, to learn the college yells and college songs, and how to split Carolina for the team. Organized mass cheering led by a cheerleader was a new experience for me, and it was exhilarating. Parson Moss told us it was the real explanation of the fall of Jericho, the children of Israel marching around the walls 7 times with horns and trumpets and shouting till the walls collapsed, just as opposing teams were honor-bound to do when our cheering section went into action, regardless of the team's performance. And they did collapse, often enough to make us feel our cheering was worthwhile. There was the visit I made with a fellow freshman to see our faculty advisor, Professor Oliver Towles of the French department. It was the first year of the faculty advisor system, designed to give new students at least one person on the faculty to whom they could go for advice and counsel. Professor Towles welcomed us with exquisite courtesy. He was the first full-blooded faculty member we had met. After talking with us for a while, he brought out some wine, in the smallest, thinnest glasses I had ever seen, so fragile that I feared mine would shatter if I held it tight enough to keep it from slipping through my fingers. I had been brought up in dry territory and taught not to look upon the wine when it is red, or any other color. The professor's expectation that we would take it prevailed over our breeding, but when we came to go and thanked him for his courtesy, our sense of guilt was strong enough for us to read a conspiratorial note in his softly spoken reply, "Don't mention it." My companion responded in a whisper, "We won't." There was my visit to the furniture store to inquire about the price of a table for my room. While the storekeeper was answering my question, it occurred to me that I was talking not to one of the merchants in Smithfield who knew me, but to a stranger. To avoid embarrassment, I casually asked if he ever gave credit to freshmen. He immediately lost interest in me as a prospective customer, and informed me with impeccable politeness. There are 2 sorts of accounts I do not accept. One is where the party is unreliable. The other is where the account is too small. Yours is too small. In that moment, I felt that I was a long way from home. There was the post office, where almost all of the 800 students would meet at noon and night. Whether they were expecting mail or not, they would inquire for it, and as the mail was usually late, students would have an hour or more to mill around. It was the melting pot of the campus in my college years, and continued to be so until the growth of the university in later days required delivery of mail to dormitories, and the decentralizing process began. Woe to the unfortunate freshman who got caught in the middle of that pushing, shoving, packing crowd at the post office. It could quickly form a circle and send him reeling to all points of the compass. Taking early impressions altogether, I knew I was being introduced into a strange new world, but I was not sure it was the promised land. In the public school, I had run up against boys who came from homes in the town of Smithfield and a surrounding 3-mile radius, the best the community had to offer. In Chapel Hill, I was meeting boys who came from homes throughout the state and beyond, the best that North Carolina had to offer. I felt the enlarging power of a new dimension that would expand my horizon and stretch my powers to their limits. These impressions are what the University of North Carolina meant to me. Teachers and courses. There was Norman Forster, who taught me freshman English. The course was built around a textbook called Essays for College Men. The essays were written by great educators, including Woodrow Wilson, John Henry Newman, Thomas Henry Huxley, Matthew Arnold, William James, Alexander Michael John, John Tyndall, George Edward Woodberry, and others. They gave me an insight into the meaning of the liberal arts. There was nothing soft about the reading matter, and nothing soft about the teaching. We were required to get the meaning of those essays, and to make certain that we did, we were required to write the topic sentence for every paragraph. It was not enough to read the lines. We had to read between the lines, get the author's tones and overtones, put them in our own words, and make them our own. Professor Forster was the first member of the faculty to invite me into his home for a meal, Thanksgiving dinner. And I remember to this day the grace and quietude with which he and Mrs. Forster made a freshman feel at home. There was Frank Graham, who taught the course in American history. It began with the discovery of the compass and improvements in shipbuilding and in the art of navigation that brought ships to the New World. It continued with the native Indian tribes and went as far as the Civil War. Professor Graham turned the class into a model of the United States Senate and reproduced the Hayne-Webster debates to the last detail, with students presenting the arguments in the rough and tumble of debate. His classroom was a place not to sit and listen and remember, but to think and analyze and understand. There was the survey of English literature in my sophomore year, cutting a trail through history with generous samplings of poetry from Chaucer, Spenser, Marlowe, Ben Jonson, Milton, Dryden, Pope, Burns, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Byron, Shelley, Keats, Tennyson, Browning, and Matthew Arnold, and of prose from Bacon, Swift, Addison, Steele, Samuel Johnson, Edmund Burke, Carlyle, Macaulay, Thackeray, Ruskin, Huxley, and Robert Louis Stevenson. These samplings were fascinating in themselves and served their purpose of leading me into the bypaths of reading and enjoyment that have enriched my life beyond measure through the years. I kept the books and have gone back to them over and over again for the lift in spirit which these associations bring. There was Collier Cobb, who taught me the course in Geology I my sophomore year. It was all about the history and working of the earth, and it was much more than that. It was the nearest thing to a general science course for popular consumption that the university offered to the rank and file of students in my college days. Professor Cobb would illuminate the influence of heredity and environment with such graphic sentences as, "We are what we are largely because we are where we are. The Eskimo's lamp is a big fat duck with a wick run through it. You cannot build a great civilization in the tropics where a man can lie in a hammock and pull bananas with his fingers and dig potatoes with his toes. Human beings are an omnibus on which their ancestors ride. I would rather own a clay bank in Wayne County than all the gold mines in North Carolina." In addition to being a course in the history and structure of the earth, Geology I was a course in the personality of Collier Cobb. There was Herman Beatty, instructor in the physics lab my sophomore year. He found me sitting in front of a curious contraption called an apparatus for an experiment separating the one continuous movement of a pendulum swinging across an unticking centerpiece, confronting an unticking brain and a face that carried no speculation in its eyes. I recall his coming to my table, sizing up the situation, and touching my imagination with the story of Galileo watching the swinging chandelier in a church, and coming to the conclusion that the swing of a pendulum is the relationship between the freedom to fall and a restricting force. I was too far gone to profit by his observations at that time, and that is why the only physics I know today comes from reading Alfred Noy's poem on Watchers of the Sky and Harsanyi's novel on the life of Galileo. But I recalled this dimension in Beatty's teaching skill years later while I was helping him survey a piece of property. And when I asked him the meaning of a movement he was making, he said he was putting his transit on the North Star to get the bearings which would trace the surveyor's line along the ground. There was Edwin Greenlaw's course in the chief Elizabethan dramatists, with emphasis on Christopher Marlowe and Ben Jonson. His course in Bacon, with emphasis on the essays and the advancement of learning. His course in Shakespeare. And English 21, a course in writing. Writing of any sort a student wanted to do, with its focus on teaching him to say whatever he had to say with grace, clarity, and style. There was nothing sentimental in Professor Greenlaw's love of literature. He was a pure scientist in his effort to get at meanings and implications, and as rigorous and exacting as the physics teacher in his emphasis on discipline. He was full of feeling, but became as sheepish as a child discovered in an indiscretion whenever he showed his feelings, as now and then he did. When he said it was the business of the scholar to follow knowledge like a sinking star beyond the utmost bounds of human thought, it did not sound like high-flown rhetoric. It was the God's truth. He did not drag life into literature. He found it there. There was Horace Williams, who was a legend on the campus when I came to his course in logic in my junior year, but he lived up to and beyond the legend that had grown up around him. On the first day of the course, he gave us the names of two textbooks, Everett's The Science of Thought and Bradley's Appearance and Reality, and never mentioned them again. He never assigned parallel reading on which we would be examined. He said he wanted us to think, and keep on thinking. He repeated this saying so often that some of us began to think that outside reading was a hindrance to thought. At the beginning, he told us the single examination question that was coming at the end. Trace the thought movement in this course. That was all, and that was enough. It told him what we had and had not gotten out of the course. There was plenty of thought in the course and plenty of movement. He knew how to provoke it and sustain it. The course partook of his personality. It was a course in Horace Williams. Everything was grist to his mill. It was not a course in a specific subject matter or body of knowledge we were supposed to acquire. It was a course that threw light on all other courses and helped us get into them. Not a key opening a particular door of learning, but a master key useful in opening all doors. Professor Williams never tried to tell us what to think. He tried to see that we did think. Our own thoughts and nobody else's. He wanted to see us take flame and blaze with fires we ourselves had generated. If all of us did not catch fire, we at least got warmed up from within and grew hot from surrounding fires. Rarely did anyone have time to take notes. Professor Williams brought the course to an end by saying, "Young gentlemen, you must never forget that the processes of life run deeper than the processes of logic." Many an evening I went to his home, on what was at that time the edge of town, to read a speech I had prepared. His study was always open to his students, and if he was not as interested in our productions as in his own, we never found it out. Many an evening I heard him say, "It won't do, Mr. Coates, it won't do." "What is wrong with it?" I would ask. And he would answer, "All you've got is a lot of plank nailed together. What you need is a growing tree." Horace Williams taught his boys to think a problem through, to work on it until the moment of insight came and they could say, "I've got it." He called it the Eureka experience. With all their getting, he wanted his students to get understanding. He had a way of putting questions that was revealing and devastating. He was not in the scholarly tradition of those who did outside reading, went in for research, and collected all manner of footnotes. In the middle of a rash of questionnaires the psychology professors were circulating on the campus to find answers to all sorts of things, he put the question, "Did you ever know Jesus to send out a questionnaire?" Surrounded by articles in which footnotes were the test of scholarship, he would put the question, "Does the multiplication table call for footnotes?" It was not that he did not believe in facts. He did believe in them. But to him, they were static symbols, separate points. Bring them into a working relationship, and they become dynamic. Let them grow together into one whole greater than the sum of all its parts, and the result is organic. In Horace Williams' early days, an influential woman in Chapel Hill told him she wanted him to teach Christian philosophy. "All right," he answered. if you'll get your son-in-law in the math department to teach Christian mathematics. Professor Williams used to say that his course was like a kit of tools that a man could use to help him work his way through situations he was in, to help him solve his problems. In the vicissitudes of this life, when I've been tangled up in situations from which I saw no way out, and have gone into the closet to pray, I've always found him in there with me. There was E.C. Branson, chairman of the Department of Rural Economics and Sociology, who had been brought to the university by President Graham to broaden the base of university instruction and initiate study of specific problems in the life of the state. His courses sparked the organization of county clubs for the study of the economic and social life of the respective counties. These clubs were federated in the North Carolina Club. His students investigated population, wealth, cooperative enterprises, public highways, law and order, recreation, rural credit, churches, marketing, and home conditions. They illustrated President Graham's belief that the state and all its practical problems were a proper field of university service. The university would emphasize the fact that research and classical culture, rightly interpreted, are as deeply and completely service as any vocational service, but it would consider these services too precious to be confined to cloisters and sufficiently robust to inhabit the walks of men. In the teachings of E.C. Branson, North Carolina became a proper study for North Carolinians. I had the privilege of assisting him in the work of the North Carolina Club my senior year, when he made a detailed study of county government, which included discussions by visiting officials and authorities working in the field of local government. There was Charles Lee Raper, professor of economics, who introduced me to the ways in which the wheels go around in the business of our society. He was the dean of the graduate school and the father of the Department of Economics and the School of Commerce. His interpretations of the Old and New Testaments in the Methodist Sunday School filled the body of the church to overflowing for the 4 years of my college career and amounted to a complete course in biblical literature and the Christian tradition. He was humanly appealing to me in the classroom, in church, on the campus, wherever we met. And his interest in his students didn't end with his courses. Throughout his life, he followed my activities and inspired me with frequent comments on them. There was George Howe, who taught me Latin, and Professor Day, who taught me French, both men who taught me more than the subject matter of their courses. There were others who taught me prescribed courses for a college degree with competence and provided the bedrock of discipline in the day-to-day work of acquiring an education. Teachers who provided the base of the range which supported the men who rose to the peaks. These teachers and courses are what the University of North Carolina meant to me. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast on our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.